Today is Wednesday, May 9th. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, President Trump pulls the U.S. out of the Iran nuclear deal.
America will not be held hostage to nuclear blackmail.
America's European allies are reacting to the president's announcement. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo is on his second trip to North Korea. Also ahead, we'll tell you about a popular young singer with a big world tour. It's all on today's International Edition. President Donald Trump Tuesday formally renounced the multinational nuclear agreement with Iran, calling it a horrible one-sided deal that should have never, ever been made.
I am announcing today that the United States will withdraw from the Iran nuclear deal.
In remarks from the White House diplomatic room, Trump declared that the U.S. is immediately reinstating all Iran-related sanctions.
We will be instituting the highest level of economic sanction. Any nation that helps Iran in its quest for nuclear weapons could also be strongly sanctioned by the United States.
The 2015 pact was struck between Iran and the five permanent members of the UN Security Council, plus Germany. Trump's decision to withdraw from the agreement comes despite pleas from several of America's closest allies in Europe. After the announcement, EU Foreign Policy Chief Federica Mogherini said that they fully trust the work, competence, and autonomy of the International Atomic Energy Agency's results, which she said published 10 reports certifying that Iran had fully complied with its commitments.
The nuclear deal with Iran is the culmination of 12 years of diplomacy. It belongs to the entire international community. It has been working, and it is delivering on its goal, which is guaranteeing that Iran doesn't develop nuclear weapons.
For more on European reaction, we're joined by Paris-based journalist Catherine Field. Catherine, what are you hearing from leaders over there?
There is real dismay that President Trump made this announcement. Since then, the French president, the German chancellor, and the British prime minister have expressed their regret and their concern, and they've also emphasized their continued commitment to the Iran deal. But it really is a pivotal moment for Europe, because the whole basis of Europe is founded on the fact that the world order has America at the top. So suddenly that Europe woke up and discovered that it had no leverage with the United States, particularly with this president, it has really led them to think, what is going on? So really, they say it's dismay, but it's really shock.
Iran is talking about potentially negotiating with Europeans, even with Russia and China as well, about remaining in the deal. What would that look like without the U.S.?
It would be difficult, but let's not forget that the European Union has had four diplomats working to come to some sort of new agreement with Iran. These four diplomats have been working since the beginning of this year to try and figure out how this deal can work without the U.S. The big problem, of course, is that European companies that are present in Iran would run the risk of sanctions being imposed on them by the Americans. So that is the big problem. It's the economic problem. What sort of companies would do business with Iran? Well, certainly it wouldn't be the big companies that are in Iran at the moment. For example, Airbus Industries, Peugeot, the French car makers, who they really cannot risk doing business with Iran if they then come in for sanctions against the Americans. So that is the problem. How do you keep this agreement going without the U.S.? Well, the European Union leaders, they're going to meet in a summit next week. They're going to try and talk about this, try and figure a way forward. But certainly, they remember that this agreement did not come overnight. This was 2 years, 6 months of work, of foreign ministers clearing their diaries to be in Geneva to get this agreement done. They really did stake a lot in this agreement, and particularly the European Union. This was something that they were very proud of. They feel it can work, but really it's going to take a lot of imagination, if not imagination, just whole new thinking to be able to get it to work without the United States.
It certainly seemed like President Trump was implying that this did nothing to keep Iran from building nuclear weapons. But what does intelligence in Europe say about that? Because from my understanding, even the U.S. intelligence agency says that that Iran was complying.
No one has ever said that there hasn't been compliance. Everyone has agreed that, yes, there are other areas in how Iran is operating within the Gulf that need to be looked at. But when it comes to this specific Iran nuclear deal, everyone is saying it's working, and that is why, in particular, the European Union chiefs have now, just in the last few hours, come out and said that this is a good deal, and they are still fully committed to this deal.
Given that this U.S. president has, before this, already pulled out of the Paris Climate Accord that every other country in the world has remained in, how are the Europeans feeling about the U.S. ability to keep its agreements? Is there concern about that?
There is concern, and I don't think it's too far to say that this is the deepest crisis in transatlantic relations in a generation. People are very concerned. All sorts of people are coming out of the woodwork and saying, well, let's not forget that since the Second World War, America's word has been its bond, and now this has now undermined that. This is America standing on its own in the world. It is not America leading the world in the view of the European Union or even here in France. The view is this is America standing on its own, and that's really where the issue is now, that the U.S. has taken a more confrontational stand. It is not dealing in the same sort of diplomacy that all its European allies have been dealing in, and particularly this whole big concern that even appeasement didn't seem to work. Let's not forget that the French President Emmanuel Macron went to Washington, the German Chancellor Angela Merkel went, the UK's Foreign Secretary Boris Johnson went to Washington, that all these usual levers that used to work, that could be relied upon when Europe thought that it was alongside America as the pillars of peace, economic stability, and a world order, these pillars now seem to have disappeared.
And thank you, Catherine. We're joined now for further analysis from here in the U.S. by Robert Deitz, former special counsel of the Central Intelligence Agency and National Security Agency, currently professor at the Scharf School of Public Policy at George Mason University. What's your reaction to the president's decision to withdraw from the Iran deal?
Stuff is never quite as simple as he first makes it seem. He's presumably withdrawing from the agreement. He's announced that he's going to reinstitute sanctions. But the sanctions don't start right away. Now, as I understand it, Treasury is saying it's going to take some time to gin them up. I don't believe that for a second. They've had sanctions in the past, and this announcement certainly didn't catch anybody off guard. So I suspect that these things were all, you know, potentially in place. And I'm wondering if Mr. Trump is doing in this context what he did with respect to tariffs on imports of steel and that sort of thing. That is, I'm wondering if he's announced an intention, but then leaves himself time to negotiate something further before it actually takes place.
Well, it sounds like the Iranians aren't willing to renegotiate this deal, but they are willing to work something out with our European allies who have really pressed the president not to do this. What does this say about our credibility overall?
I think it harms our credibility. But remember, there are potential problems with the Europeans. The sanctions that Mr. Trump is talking about involve direct sanctions, but also secondary sanctions, meaning U.S. firms would not be able to deal with Iran. Nor would U.S. firms, meaning banks, effectively, be able to deal with European companies that deal with Iran. That creates a potentially huge problem for Iran. This catches Iran in a terrible situation. I'm sure you saw today that the Iranian currency has dropped in value to the lowest I think it's ever been. Iran doesn't have a lot of resources, and if it can't sell oil to us, and indirectly if it can't sell oil to the Europeans, it's in a really tight bind.
But isn't that what the president wants?
Yes, it's exactly what the president wants.
there are some who have said that this really sends a positive message to North Korea, that the U.S. isn't going to put up with being, you know, lied to or anything like that. Others say this sends a bad message because it shows that we don't fulfill our commitments, that we go back on our agreements. Which side of that argument are you on?
I'm more on the former side. Mr. Trump is willing to use assets he has to further what he views as the interests of the United States. And I think it suggests that if he doesn't get what he wants, he will, you know, take measures to obtain it. And it seems to me that's kind of a message that North Korea might notice.
All right. Well, speaking of North Korea, the White House said President Trump and Chinese President Xi Jinping spoke by phone on Tuesday and agreed that sanctions against North Korea should remain in place until it permanently dismantles its nuclear and missile programs. And it comes as U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo is in North Korea preparing for the upcoming meeting between Trump and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. Pompeo is also hoping to secure the release of three Americans detained by Pyongyang. VOA's Ira Melman talks about it with Dr. Clayton Duby, the director of the U.S.-China Institute at the University of Southern California.
What happens with the discussions with Pompeo, of course, will be, you know, very important. And, you know, President Trump seeks and likes drama. And so whether or not they, you know, release the Korean-American prisoners, whether or not they, you know, subsequently do announce when this meeting is to happen and where it's to happen and all of those sorts of things remains to be seen. But the question is, from my perspective, is are they trying to hammer out some sort of joint communique? It seems unlikely that in a short series of meetings, and that's all they've had so far, and that's all that they are planned to have, that it would be very difficult to work out with the sort of detail that would be required a real time, a plan for denuclearization and a timeline with all the verification steps and things like that.
One wonders now, and I realize this is speculation on all part because there's no answer yet, if this would have any effect on the stance of the North Koreans or anyone else in these upcoming negotiations with South Korea and the United States.
Well, smart negotiators on the North Korean side are sure to raise this as an issue. They will say, well, why should we trust the United States if it's so willing, so soon after agreeing as part of this collective agreement with Iran to end Iran's nuclear weapons development program, why North Korea should trust American determination to stay the course and to adhere to any terms of the agreement. At the same time, my own feeling is that North Korea doesn't have high expectations for these negotiations. They are making a lot of sending a lot of signs, but they don't necessarily expect to get everything that they may be seeking. Just the fact that the meeting is happening already changes the context in which the region exists. It changes the relationship that North Korea has with Japan, that North Korea has with South Korea, and that North Korea has with China. And so just the fact that Kim Jong-un is expected to meet with the American president after years and years of American president saying we have nothing to talk about is quite a victory for him.
For the second time in a few months, Kim Jong-un traveled to China to meet with Xi Jinping. Number one, did that surprise you? And what do you think Kim Jong-un wanted to accomplish, if indeed he was the impetus to the meeting, or do you think it might have been Xi Jinping?
I don't know who initiated the meeting, and it's possible that over time we will know that. That answer. I'm sure that Kim Jong-un wanted to signal to China that he was not acting against China's interests. He wanted to signal that he would maintain open communication with Beijing. and that China's concerns did matter to him. He is trying to manage his situation with South Korea, with China, and with the United States.
That's Dr. Clayton Dubey, the director of the U.S.-China Institute at the University of Southern California. Here are some of the stories we're following at voanews.com. Potential citizenship question is raising U.S. Census Bureau concerns. The Trump CIA nominee, past divides U.S. senators. Unidentified assailants shoot and wound a Montenegrin journalist. And Pakistan confirms participation in a trilateral peace conference. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. Hawaii's Kilauea volcano continues to percolate. Officials say two new cracks in the ground emitting lava and gas have opened in a community where some two dozen homes have already burned down. Officials are warning that hazardous fumes continue to be released from the cracks in the ground. Dr. Jonathan Lee from the Department of Geological Services at the University of North Carolina says the activity around the Kilauea volcano is not unexpected.
It's not a big surprise that there was an eruption and a fissure opening up in Hawaii in that part of the Big Island. That's the most active part of the Hawaiian chain.
Well, while scientists can't predict when the volcano will cease eruption, Lee says signs will present themselves beforehand.
They'll be looking at the rate of seismic activity. They'll look at the size of the earthquakes, where they're distributed, how they move from one place to another, whether they're clustered, whether they're not clustered. They'll look at things like harmonic tremor from some of the events. And as these things start to subside, then they will say, it looks like things are dying down.
Hawaii Governor David Icke says he's called the White House and the Federal Emergency Management Agency to tell officials that he believes the state will be needing federal help. You're listening to International Edition on VOA.
Hey, sports fans, brighten your day by tuning into the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny and on Twitter at VOA Sunny Sports. Or check out the blog at blogs.voanews.com/sunny. It's the sunny side of sports right here on the Voice of America.
Whether it's happening here in Washington or in your part of the world, Issues in the News brings context and balance to some of the world's most compelling stories. Join prominent Washington correspondents as they discuss the week's headlines every Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America. You can also download our podcast from iTunes or listen in on our website, voanews.com/programs/radio. That's Issues in the News on The Voice of America.
VOA's International Edition continues. According to a recent Gallup poll, for the 17th straight year, nurses are the most trusted profession. Here in the U.S., it's widely known that before and after the doctors even show up, it's the nurses who are often so offering so much in physical and emotional support to patients. And this week is Nurses Week. Joining us to talk about what that all means is Jennifer Doyle, president of A1, the Association of Women's Health, Obstetrics, and Neonatal Nurses. So what exactly is Nurses Week?
Nurses Week is a time that we can celebrate and honor the work that nurses do every single day. And to really, it's our opportunity to also educate the public about our role in healthcare. In the last 17 consecutive years, nursing, the profession of nursing, has been noted the top trusted profession in the country by a Gallup poll.
Wow. Do you have a particular theme this year for Nurses Week?
Absolutely. The theme this year is inspire, innovate, and influence. And of course, as nurses, we're always happy to inspire people every single day, innovate. You know, nurses are very innovative, whether we're at the bedside, in the boardroom, or the classroom. But really, it's that influence, educating our families and our patients about their health and what's going on with them, and also influencing public policy. If at all possible. And I think we have some really important work to be done in the coming years.
Any specifics on what you'll be focusing on within that theme?
Our main focus is the health and safety of women and newborns. And so we have three target points that we're really interested in. And one is decreasing the opioid epidemic, and certainly the effect of that on the neonates that we specifically serve and their families. One is decreasing maternal mortality and reducing disparities therein. And also it's promoting and supporting paid family leave.
And why is that so important?
Paid family leave is so important because, less than 13% of people in this country have access to paid family leave. And certainly within our specialty, you know, we're most interested in breastfeeding and bonding and making sure, did you know that if 90% of women, after they delivered, exclusively breastfed up to 6 months after delivery, that the cost to the healthcare system would be about $13 billion. That's with a B, dollars. So it's a huge, breastfeeding and bonding is a huge benefit to the health of the babies that we take care of and our children. They're our future, right? Mm-hmm. Everything from decreasing ear infections to decreasing their chance of diabetes later in life. So it's a very important time.
Absolutely. And you mentioned the opioid epidemic. I would assume it's possible that babies can be born dependent on opioids, and that's obviously a horrible thought.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. They can be born, and they are born often. That has increased threefold in the last 15 years. Some 6 babies out of every 1,000 are born dependent on opioids. And so what we really need to do is increase treatment availabilities and the providers who can provide that treatment and medication, because right now there's just not enough. So specifically in our specialty area, you know, pregnant women who have an opioid addiction or opioid dependence, they have trouble finding help and finding somebody who can prescribe them medication so that they're not using illicit drugs or, street drugs like heroin. So it's really important that we support the increasing access to opioid dependent treatment act.
That's Jennifer Doyle, president of the Association of Women's Health, Obstetric and Neonatal Nurses. Well, a popular young singer has a new single and new album and will begin a big world tour next year. VOA's Border Crossings host Larry London joins International Edition's Sarah Williams with the latest.
Today, we've got a Canadian singer, songwriter, very talented young man who's just 19. His name is Shawn Mendes. And he's putting out his third album on the 25th of May, which is called Shawn Mendes. And today, he just announced a global arena tour that won't actually begin until March of 2019, but he's going all around the world for his newest album. This album, he says, is definitely more personal and more mature than anything he's put out in the past, because when he first got started, he was only 15, and he was putting videos out on Vine, which are those very short, limited videos that kind of disappear after they're on there for a little bit. He was discovered that way by all of his fans. They love him. He's put out several other albums. Illuminate was his last album a couple of years ago. He was on tour with Charlie Puth over the last year. But we're finally going to get to hear Shawn Mendes' brand new album, a more mature Shawn Mendes. And this song is called In My Blood. So let's take a listen to it.
It isn't in my blood. Laying on the bathroom floor, feeling nothing. I'm overwhelmed and insecure. Give me something I could take to ease my mind slowly.
He's mature at the age of 19.
Yeah, as far as a 19-year-old is concerned. But he's dealing with mature subject matter. He said that he couldn't really make songs at 15 and 16 about issues that he couldn't relate to or didn't feel comfortable talking about. Unlike a lot of pop stars these days who are talking about a variety of things, sexual, intimate, whatever, Shawn Mendes has avoided that subject matter until now. He's kind of pushing the envelope just a little bit. The new album, by the way, the first two songs he's already put out, Lost in Japan and the one we heard, In My Blood, are number one and number two on iTunes, respectively. And in about 50 other countries, those songs are shooting up the top of the charts. So he's getting a lot of attention. There's a lot of talk about him, a lot of focus on him. The new album contains a song called Youth, which Shawn says is a very personal song that he wrote while he was in Europe about a month before the Manchester suicide bomb blew up during Ariana Grande's concert. He said that really impacted him. And then back in the States this past year, of course, with the shooting in Parkland, Florida at the high school, where a number of kids, I think 17 students lost their lives, students and adults lost their lives. He said that really hit home. That touched him because he's got a younger sister. And he said, I started to worry about how all of this is going to impact his younger sister. So he recorded a song on the new album called Youth, and he did it with an artist named Khalid. He said all the proceeds on the sales of that song are going to go to the March for Our Lives, which was the big march that took place here in Washington, D.C. Those students led that march, that anti-gun violence protest that took place. But Shawn Mendes, you know, he's put out some great music over the last few years, and we're looking forward to the new sound. The new album includes collaborations with Ryan Tedder, John Mayer, Ed Sheeran, among others. So we know that's a pretty hefty lineup of stars, and I can't wait to hear the album. May 25th, that's the date.
And do you happen to know where the tour next year, where that's going to begin?
It says 56 dates, March 7th, first show in Europe, running through the summer of 2019.
Thanks a lot, Larry. That's Larry London. He's the host of VOA's Border Crossings.
Help me. It's like the walls are caving in. Sometimes I feel like giving up. No medicine is strong enough.
You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for today's show, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. Thank you for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Greg Burns. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
In an effort to assist the economies of sub-Saharan Africa and to facilitate trade between the region and the United States, the U.S. government initiated in the year 2000 the African Growth and Opportunity Act, or AGOA. Under the act, regional trade hubs, or technical assistance centers, were created. The USAID trade and investment hubs located in Ghana, South Africa, and Kenya assist, enhance, and broaden the flow of trade between the United States and Africa. The hubs, which are managed by the U.S. Agency for International Development, bring together African and U.S. businesses to attract investment to Africa and promote two-way trade between the United States and African countries, creating jobs and generating income for all of us. The hubs increase regional integration, which creates ever larger markets for U.S. goods and services and improves food security by increasing the movement of food across borders. The hubs also promote two-way trade with the United States under AGOA and facilitate investment and technology to drive trade growth throughout the region as well as globally. In that, they have been spectacularly successful, said USAID West Africa Mission Director Alex Duprez.
Since 2010, USAID's regional trade hubs have facilitated more than $300 million in new finance and investment, almost $1 billion in AGOA exports, and created more than 60,000 new jobs right here in Africa.
Speaking at an AGOA capacity building and skills development workshop in Accra, Ghana, in late April, Director Duprez cited progress in Ghana to illustrate his point.
Here in Ghana, for example, we have a range of wonderful products that are now entering the U.S. market, including cocoa, shea, cashew, and dried mango. An encouraging sign is that these products are often now moving as cocoa butter and cocoa powder instead of beans. Many products are also being exported as soaps instead of shea nut and sold as kernels rather than as raw cashew. Value addition is increasing.
And the future looks because West Africa has a large emerging middle class. The business opportunities to supply this rapidly growing middle class and the markets of the region are enormous, said Director Deprez. The U.S. is committed to Africa, and USAID remains a partner to supporting your efforts to grow and deepen trade relationships.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.